Hello, welcome back to the next episode of the Matchroom Experience. Today we're on number 17 with a very special guest. Super excited. I have Dr. Jim Davies. Say hello.
Hi.
And just to get started here, just for people who don't know who you are, could you give a little bit of an introduction of who you are, maybe just a quick minute or two?
Sure. My name is Jim Davies. I'm a professor of cognitive science at Carleton University. We have a cognitive science department there. And I like to write popular science books. Mm-hmm. My most recent one was Imagination, the Science of Your Mind's Greatest Power. And the book we'll be talking about today is Riveted, the Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. My research is about imagination, and I teach general cognitive science.
And Riveted, you're right, that's the book that I found you from, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you for writing it, first of all.
Thank you.
For people who don't know what the book is about, you kind of gave a little bit of a subtitle there. How would you describe it?
You know, the subtitle is actually really hard to come up with because the book's about so many things, and trying to get a feel for that in the title is, I don't even know if it was entirely successful. But the impetus of the book was to try to find the underlying psychological factors that are involved in why we find anything compelling. So I was interested in religion and art and sports and jokes. And, you know, why do we like find some things really worthy of attention and feel important and other things not? So, you know, the feeling of being riveted to something. So that's what it's about. So it's trying to explain the underlying psychology of why things grab us.
I love that. And if it's not obvious already, why would this be something that's important for the average person to learn about?
There are a couple of reasons. One is that if you understand these things, you can make important stuff more riveting to people. So you can, if you have an important message to get out there, there might be some things in the book that would give you clues as to what kinds of things do really well in people's minds and which things fail. I mean, it's not a how-to book, mm-hmm. but I think the more important lesson of it is that it really... people have said after they've read the book that they look at everything differently. So, and that's what I want, is that after you know your own biases and why you find certain things compelling, you might have more of a psychological immune system. You know, when somebody attractive is telling you something, you know, after reading my book, that you're more likely to believe it just because they're attractive and not because they're making any sense, for example. Right. So I think it can help people be a little bit more circumspect with claims made by advertisers or politicians or whoever, who have teams of people working very hard to get you riveted.
Right. And I love that you said that. I actually just did an interview with John Verbeke. He's another psychologist at the University of Toronto. And one
John.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
One of the things he talked about was how Socrates talked on how we find certain things salient or compelling. And if we don't know what those things are, we're going to be pulled in different directions without really knowing why we're doing these things. And your book, I think, does a really good job of kind of bringing these biases to light and helping us realize what's going on there.
Oh, thank you.
So just to get into it, in your book, you give us sort of a framework where you have six kind of main things that we find compelling. Could you kind of just give a brief overview of what they are first?
Well, I don't want to talk about all of them. And part of the reason is because I know from my research and writing the book that if I give people the impression that they understand everything from the book, they're not going to read it.
Okay.
Because a feeling of understanding and closure allows your brain to stop thinking about something. And something that let's talk about that first. So the incongruity is one of the main foundations. And incongruity is more involved with interest. Something I learned since I wrote the book is that interest and pleasure are different systems that actually use different brain mechanisms. So the interest system is much more about dopamine, and pleasure is much more about the opioid system. So when you are dealing with puzzles, or there's a movie and there's a cliffhanger and you don't know what's going to happen, or something strange happens in a story, or there's a little splot of paint on a painting that doesn't seem to fit with everything else, that generates a feeling of interest and a desire to learn more and try to understand. On the other side, seeing patterns. understanding things, coming to an understanding and figuring things out, maybe seeing the underlying pattern that initially was obscured, that is a pleasure activation in your brain. So the way I look at it is you've got these interests and pleasures. Those are two of the foundations. I call them pattern and incongruity. And you can see that with a lot of arts, for example, particularly music and stories, it works. The ones that work really well often do so because they manipulate very exquisitely your pleasure and your interest. They set up a tension, something that doesn't make sense or something that's uncertain, and then they resolve it and you get this great feeling. You can do that with plot points, but you can also do it with music resolve. So if there's a, the keys are going into minor and you want a resolution to it, the full resolution, gives you a feeling of satisfaction and pleasure. Those are two of them. Another one is, another big one is that we are attracted to anything that has to do with people. So if it's about people or you make it about people, like you talk about mountains or fish or something as though they had psychological states, that makes us much more interested in them. So the book is, it's about things like that. I don't want to give away all the things, but those are like the kinds of things that the book gets into.
The first chapter is actually about people, and that's actually the one that I found the most interesting. So I guess that compelled me the most. One of the more intriguing facts that you wrote about was how we find groups of under five in paintings more compelling than groups over five. Can you kind of describe the reason for that?
Well, part of it is that we have a natural ability to see how many things there are if there are fewer than five things. So if you if somebody throws like four apples on a table, you can kind of instantly know that there are four apples without counting them. Once you get above five, though, typically you have to count. So in terms of what I was just talking about with pattern and the pleasure of seeing a pattern, just being able to instantly recognize how many things there are means something to you. Okay. Now, if there are like 17, let's say people or anything, actually 17 objects or 17 people all in your visual field, say at the same time, you don't get the immediate impression of the number 17. In fact, you might not even bother counting unless you had a particular reason to. What you're going to see is an overall texture. Like when you get more than five things, whatever you're looking at becomes a texture. Like let's take looking at a lawn of grass. You don't see every individual blade, right? You just see, it's grass. It's a texture of grass. And when you have a whole lot of different people, it becomes a crowd. And crowds are just a little less interesting than individual people because crowds typically don't have psychological states, beliefs and desires. Sometimes they have desires if they're a mob or something, and you do see paintings like that. But in general, if you've got only one or two or three people, your mind is much more easily can tell a story about what's going on, and they are individual people, and they sort of trigger your desire to understand social things.
Mm-hmm. And inherently, we find people more interesting than other sort of objects, right? We can see this. I think you argue in your book, and you said it today too. The water tries to trickle down the mountain. As a marketer, if somebody was a marketer and they were to listen to this and try to figure out how they could apply this to their marketing and to their advertisements, what kind of suggestion would you give to them?
Well, there have been studies that show that people love their iPhones, and what I mean like literally love, like by the measures that we have. They appear to actually be in love in some way, like it's got the same emotional stuff. And so playing upon, you could like products might be classified as a friend or something, or, anthropomorphizing objects or companies or ideas is a way to endear people to them.
And that's probably why a lot of brands, they'll have personalities to them. I did business school, and one of the things we talked about there was having a brand personality. That's kind of seeing that play out, would you say?
Well, I'm not really sure what they mean when they say that. Like, what kind of things do you do to give a brand a personality?
They would say...
Like playfulness or something? Like Volkswagen is playful, that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that... You can generate feelings of playfulness or anger in somebody without making them think that the thing that they're looking at is playful or angry. For example, the color red is a passionate color. But when you look at a red wall, you don't think that the wall is angry. Like, you might not personify the wall, although it might trigger something in you. So I feel like if you've got like a mascot, like Tony the Tiger or somebody, he's enthusiastic. And so in that case, yes, you're absolutely anthropomorphizing because you actually have a character like Ronald McDonald or something like that. But yeah, I'm not sure that all of that is anthropomorphization, but it's always trying to generate some kind of a feeling in the person. I mean, I bet in the business world, when they say personality, usually they mean emotion and not actually personality, like neuroticism and, you know, all the different aspects of actual personality. They probably mean, what they usually mean is probably positive emotion, either serious or playful. Right.
Right. One of the things I did to prepare for this interview is I tried to think of what are some of the more compelling ideas that we as people tend to have, or what kind of events are more compelling in our culture than others. In your book, you talk a lot about religion as one, and that's a great example. But I kind of wanted to ask you another one. The Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is probably one of the more compelling things that happen in our lives, not for some people more so than others.
Sure.
Using your framework, could you kind of try to describe why is the Super Bowl so compelling? Why do people find this so interesting?
Oh, sure. You know, this is actually a much longer discussion. And if people are interested, I do have an episode of my own podcast, Minding the Brain, about the psychology of sports. Mm-hmm. So the Super Bowl is compelling for people. When I say it's compelling, what I mean, of course, is for people for whom it is compelling. I don't watch the Super Bowl, but, you know, some people love it. And this goes for any big sporting event. And it's actually generally true for sports spectatorship in general. So it's got all the things going for it. It's got human beings in it. Okay. So it's got the social aspect in that you have humans competing in sports. And this is one reason why the Super Bowl is more popular than, say, shot put or other sports that are only competitive in the sense that you're trying to beat somebody else's score, but you're not really going head to head against somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, in darts, actually, I'm not sure about darts, but in some games, bowling, for example, you're playing against other people, but what you do doesn't directly affect their game. Okay. It's only it's like a race. It's who gets the highest score. So when you've got football, for example, American football, you've got competition with people on the same field, and also resembles conflict that we all find instinctively mesmerizing, which is violence. We also love violence. We like to watch violent TV shows and movies. We like to hear about violence. Like, stories often involve way more violence than the real world has. And there's a cross-species tendency to have symbolic violence. So crabs will, like, wave their claws around, and then the one with the bigger, like, claw will win, even though nobody has to get hurt. And so it makes sense to think that there's actually some kind of symbolic violence going on with football and boxing and hockey. I mean, like, lots of these games actually have hitting in it. You know, you're running into people or hitting. And then, on top of that, people are also often tied to their home team. So if your home team is playing against a different town, not only are you getting the symbolic violence, but it's somebody who's sort of in your court. It's violence done by someone who's representing you, like a champion in a way. I could go on and on, but, like, those are some of the, like, reasons that we love it.
Okay. And then with the violence, that's probably some sort of primal desire. Maybe it's something that we fear. That's why we find it compelling. Or maybe, what would you say?
Violence is much more common in the world that we human beings evolved in than it is today. Violence has decreased significantly over the centuries. So the world is much less violent than it used to be. So people had to constantly be wary of people in other groups, hurting them, being raided by other groups. You know, the murder rate in hunter-gatherer societies, for example, is quite high. So, you know, and surviving is obviously an important part of, reproducing. So being attentive to violence, not only for your own safety and the safety of your kin, but also violence is important because it determines the social structure of the people around you. So if two people get into a fight, in your even in your group, you need to know who wins the fight because it changes the social structure of the group. If if like the pack leader is usurped by some younger animal, you need to know that. Like navigating the social group is imperative for your survival. So that's why not only is watching like the Super Bowl fun, but it feels important in a way that it's like, when you think about it rationally, of course it's not important. Like it doesn't matter to anything really, but like it feels like important to find out who won. And I think that this is speculative, right? This is not like totally backed up by science, but like other things that we know from science suggest this, and it's consistent with what we know of science, but it's not like proven. But my understanding of it is that you are subconsciously trying to attend to the changing social structure of your society, and that's why people they don't want to miss the game or something, you know what I mean? They want up-to-date information. They have to know what happened.
Right. Okay, so this is great, and it's good that we know kind of why we might be interested in certain things now, but how do we kind of apply this to our lives? Does just having the knowledge of why you're being compelled things help you make better decisions?
I think it can, because it can help you. Like, let's take video games, for example. There are people who are addicted to video games. Like, they can't stop playing them. And really, video games, their drawbacks and benefits to you are... there are studies showing that they help you in some ways and hurt you in others. But I think everyone will kind of agree that they're a waste of time. Like, at best, they are a distraction, a pleasurable distraction. But nobody thinks that you're actually being productive in any way when you're playing a video game. But those video games are absolutely designed to make you feel like you're being productive. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, some people have reported that they play video games at work so that they can feel productive. Now, how ironic is that? That the work environment is not providing the kinds of rewards and feedback and sense of, and like dings and whistles and badges and whatever the video games have that make them feel satisfied at work. So they do something completely useless. And understand, and like when you read Riveted and you start to really understand, like, oh my God, the people who make these video games, the people who make Facebook, the people who make advertising, they are tapping into my brain and making me think these things are important, but I know better now. Like, I think that without the knowledge, it's easy to trust your instincts.
Right.
What feels important actually is, and that is absolutely not true, particularly in a world where people, very smart people, are paid a lot of money to trick your brain into thinking that something's important.
They pretty much hijack, you could say, your mental mechanism.
Exactly. Yeah. They are trying very hard to hijack you and make you feel like, basically, they want you to find something important so they can make money, or they can get their political agenda, or whatever it is. And you, or your listeners, everybody has a responsibility to step back and say, okay, just because I feel like it's important, let's use logic here. Let's use rationale. Is it actually important? Like, if I, like, I haven't finished this video game. Like, I know people who, like, who will say, oh man, I haven't finished that video game and I really should finish it before I start another one. Why? Like, who cares? Like, you know, there's no real world benefit to finishing a video game. It's only your sense of accomplishment that was evolved to actually do things in the world. And it's getting tricked into accomplishing something in a virtual world where you get nothing. And so people can waste their life away.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I can already imagine people out there might be saying video games is one thing, but this probably applies to everything, like TV shows, Netflix, YouTube.
Well, it applies to books. It applies to novels. Yeah, like, most novels are not, like, novels that keep you, like, riveted. I love reading them, and I try to write them. But I'm under no illusions that reading a novel is a productive thing to do. I think it's basically, at best, a pleasurable activity, but it's kind of a waste of time. Like, I don't let myself read a novel if I can help it. I will only read a novel if I need the break. Basically, it's to recharge my battery so I can get back to doing something that actually matters. And you know, that's the way, it's a harsh mistress, but that's the way I live my life. I'm always thinking, how do I get back to work on the things that are most important? And there's a whole laundry list of activities that are fun and feel rewarding mm-hmm. that are not in line with my values.
And again, this all starts with bringing what you find compelling, you know, what causes you to find things compelling to light, so you can realize is what you're doing for the right reasons.
Yeah, you know, I think everyone can relate to this with food, for example. Junk food tastes fabulous, mm-hmm. like Swiss cake rolls and ice cream and pizza. I mean, it tastes really, really good. And exactly like a video game, it is designed by people who are tricking your mind into thinking that you're eating something nutritious.
Right. Because we evolved in a way so that we like sugar, but today sugar is very rampant, whereas back in when we were evolving, maybe, or when we were 50,000 years ago, the only type of sugar or sweets we might have got was maybe honey.
Yeah, and I recently read, like, they were tracking this hunter-gatherer on his hunt, and he mm-hmm. spontaneously found a beehive, and he drank a pint of honey. Like, in one sitting, drank a pint of honey. Now, most of us would be like, oh, my God, that's too much honey. But it just shows you how desperate a hunter-gatherer is for sugar. And when you yeah. so when you put, like, a hunter-gatherer brain at the quickie, it's no wonder they go nuts, and it's the same hijacking.
And a lot of people don't realize, even today, you know, 50,000 years in the grand scheme of time is not a huge amount. It's more like a blink, and we still have our old primitive, you could call them, brains.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's all I have for you, Jim. Is there anywhere people can find you, though? You said you have a podcast?
Yes. I have a new podcast. It just won an award. It's called Minding the Brain. You can get it on any podcast thing like Apple or Stitcher. Or you can go to Minding the Brain. MindingTheBrainPodcast.com also has it. Mm-hmm. My latest book is the Imagination book. So we've been talking about Riveted. My latest book is Imagination, which is available in multiple formats. And I just found out it's actually available on Spotify. So if you have Spotify, sweet. You can just listen to the book free.
Oh, really? That is
That's right.
pretty sick offer.
That's
then.
A plus. No excuse.
I'm going to get on it then. Well, thank you for coming on, Jim, again. It's really a pleasure. Very interesting stuff. I loved how you did a deep dive into a few of the different kind of frameworks you have in there in your book. People want to get, you know, a more comprehensive view. Of course, they have to go check out your book, Riveted. They could probably find it on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Or anywhere, any sort of bookstore.
Yep.
And yeah, thanks again.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too.